The following lecture is part of the Quid Est Homo lecture series offered by the Personalist Project, a non-profit organization in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Recordings of our lectures are available free of charge at our website. For more information or to make a donation in support of our work, please visit us at www.thepersonalistproject.org.
When I'm done, you can all declare philosophy majors by the door. So, von Hildebrand on sexuality, I want to discuss with him three ways of attraction, three dangers in action, and three reasons for renunciation in connection with sexuality. And these thoughts come from von Hildebrand's work entitled Purity, the Mystery of Christian Sexuality. That was the title given to it when it was reprinted by Franciscan University. It was originally published under the title In Defense of Purity. It's at the moment out of print. It's being considered for being reprinted. And I think you can get a photocopy version from the Franciscan University bookstore if you're interested. First, a little background. Dieter von Hildebrand was born in 1889, died in 1977. And this book was written back in the 1920s when he was a young professor at the University of Munich. And he was warned by his colleagues in the professoriate that this was not the way to get ahead in German universities. That is, to write books defending the Catholic ideals of purity and virginity. But he saw it as truly what the age needed, regardless of his career. He later profoundly influenced Pope Pius XII on this and other topics. Pius XII called him a 20th century doctor of the church. And Paul VI sent von Hildebrand a special personal note of thanks after the latter, in the midst of the dissent over Humanae Vitae, published a book entitled A Sign of Contradiction, defending the encyclical. Recently, Cardinal Ratzinger, now Benedict XVI, wrote in his preface to von Hildebrand's biography, The Soul of a Lion, quote, "How could I in a few lines do justice to a man whose life and work have left such an indelible mark on the history of the church in this century of tragedies and triumphs? His extensive writings on Christian philosophy, spiritual theology, and in defense of the church's teaching place him among the great thinkers of the 20th century." And Benedict shares personally, because he used to go to von Hildebrand's house and experienced his personality and style of communication in some of these evenings von Hildebrand would have. He says, "The joy and freshness of his understanding of Catholic doctrine were contagious and stood in marked contrast to the dryness of a type of scholasticism that seemed then to have become stale and brittle. Listening to him, one recognized that it was the transcendent beauty of truth that had captured his heart and mind. I'm personally convinced that when at some time in the future the intellectual history of the Catholic Church in the 20th century is written, the name of Dietrich von Hildebrand will be most prominent among the figures of our time," unquote. So I want to return to this early work of his, from the 1920s on sexuality, to try to catch the spirit of this great and sensitive thinker. He attempts to unfold the essence of this unique and intimate sphere of sexuality in human life. And in doing so, he anticipates many of the tremendous personalist insights of John Paul II, Karol Wojtyła, on sexuality, of course, from his Love and Responsibility and his Theology of the Body studies. After I myself absorbed a concentrated dose of the modern approach to sexuality as an undergraduate psychology major, and I characterize that modern approach as to some extent unhinged from love, commitment, responsibility, and true joy, von Hildebrand to me was a breath of fresh air and removed the scales from my eyes. And I never thought I would see his equal in approaching this sphere until I read Wojtyła, who indeed I think is at least von Hildebrand's equal here, and in some ways surpasses him on the unfolding of the development of the theology of the gift in interpersonal communion, and of course in the reflection of God as a trinity of love through the sexual difference and the marital act. And of course that vision of the married couple in openness to a third, a child, in vision of the Trinity, that what's unique about that, of course, is that it incorporates the body into the personal communion and incorporates the body into the image of the Trinity. And so Wojtyła develops some of these themes even more, of course. Now, in von Hildebrand's work, I think in this book, he exemplifies this sensitivity to the inner states of the person, for which he was praised greatly by the famous Edmund Husserl, the father of the phenomenological movement, under whom von Hildebrand did his doctoral dissertation on moral attitudes. And although it's a long quote, I'll cut it down to a sentence or two, Husserl's evaluation. He ends it saying, "But the real strength of this work and its most significant and original results concerning the affective sphere are mainly found in the analyses of that sphere in part two, etc. We are simply astonished at the incomparably intimate knowledge that the author has of the various formations of affective consciousness and of the objective correlates of affective consciousness." So, turning this intimate acuity toward the sphere of sexuality, von Hildebrand begins by pointing out that the true meaning of sex involves its mysterious and essential relation to or ordination to higher attitudes, specifically to love. In this respect, in other words, sexuality is different from other bodily appetites in that sexuality is essentially deep. That is, it does not reveal an ultimate depth and importance just on extreme occasions, as with other bodily appetites, as for example when a man is starving or dying of thirst or deprived of sleep as a torture technique, then we realize how ultimately we're completely dependent on these foundations for our bodily life. But sex has a depth intrinsic to its own sphere. It involves the secret of the person, his intimate life and being. Thus, it involves the person's soul and the whole mystery of the soul in its unity with the body. In and with the sexual act, a man gives himself to another. He can make himself a special gift to another and receive that gift from the other. So there's a special intimacy here that involves the secret inner life of the person and thus the depth of the gift implied. And it's not the gift of a mere physical pleasure, although of course that's part of it, but the sexual act is not the same as giving someone a head rub or a foot massage. It involves something more intimate and deep. And that's why sexuality is essentially ordained toward unity with such a deep spiritual attitude as love. Due to its intrinsic depth, it can be related to such a high attitude as love, and it must be so related in order to attain its true meaning. And I think we can catch sight of this special depth of this sphere if you think of the difference between being in a superficial and distracted state of mind while eating a good meal, even if it's a fine steak and wine and you barely taste it because you're distracted, that's too bad, you see. But compare that to being in such a state of distraction while kissing the girl you deeply love. Then you're in deeper trouble, you see, if you're distracted in the midst of your kiss, you see. And this implies, again, something intrinsically deep and intimate and ordained toward love and gift and openness about the sphere of sexuality. Nonetheless, tragically, this sphere can also come unhinged from love. And thus, von Hildebrand discusses three ways in which sex can be attractive, three ways that still display this extraordinary dimension of sexuality. First, it can be a deep and intimate central dimension of the person, as I've been describing, a mystery, a gift, expressing a deep unity of life and a deep love. In that light, something awesome, worthy of marveling at in its power and depth, and yet at the same time, something noble and chaste and holy is involved here. Even sacred in its implication of a lifelong vocation of love, as well as in the origin of a new life. And of course, it was raised to the level of a sacrament. So this is sex in its true positive dimension, as we've been describing, and it's one way sex can be attractive. However, it can also come unhinged from its depth and present itself as a sphere of special fascination independent of committed love and of self-donation and independent of the procreative dimension. In other words, it can involve and attract as a temptation to exclude anything deeper. And this is the seductive magic of sexuality in isolation from any real committed love. Here it becomes superficial and degrading, a mere plaything. However, despite the seemingly playful atmosphere, here also a certain hardness can form, involving the rejection of the desire or the possibility of anything deeper. Now, this can often be presented in a pseudo-positive or a playful light as if it's all just harmless fun. And I think the image here would be Playboy bunnies in all their artificiality, you see. And it's presented as if this is just a great natural good to be savored. But it's really a betrayal of the depth and the intimacy and the seriousness of sexuality, of the mutual gift of our whole lives to each other that it implies, as well as openness to a new gift. And it replaces the deep joy of loving union with a superficial use of the other or of both toward each other as sexual playthings. Now, often those who advocate such an approach regard those who object to it as just prudish and repressed, especially traditional Christians. In other words, they're just unable to glory in the natural good of sex. They're too guilt-ridden and repressed. But I would say the Christian vision here is really an attempt to keep sex deep and true, not to deny its goodness. And the difficulty with this playful attitude is, playful in quotes, is this supposedly harmless, natural attitude does actually over time, I think, lead to a hardening of the person. You have to sort of harden yourself against the deeper dimensions of love and sex. You have to sort of have a settled refusal to allow yourself to be touched on any deeper level. And this even comes out in popular movies like Moulin Rouge, you know, where everybody's supposed to just enjoy the party, but you're never supposed to really fall in love. But see, if you want to stay on that level of just playing around, then you have to run from depth. And I think this is captured in an old rock song. I lost track of rock in 1972, by the way, so all my examples are way back. From Dion and the Belmonts, The Wanderer. And this was before Dion, by the way, rediscovered his Catholic faith and wrote a song entitled The Chapels of Ave Maria for Tom Monahan down at Ave Maria University. Very beautiful song. Dion now witnesses to the Christian faith. But in the old days, in The Wanderer, he sings, "When I find myself falling for some girl, I hop right into that car of mine and drive around the world." See, run from depth. And eventually, I think that hardens you on a more superficial level. So sex as a superficial plaything divorced from love is a second way in which it can attract us and still have an extraordinary attraction. You recognize it's not the same as other instincts. You know, it's something special, but it's misinterpreted. Now, a third way sex in its extraordinary power can be acknowledged, but in this case, the second way of distortion, would be sex can be used in a much darker way, more as a means of controlling or overpowering or consuming another person. And in this context, sex involves an outspoken selfishness and a deep pride in its motive. If the second point had more to do with a superficial concupiscence, this has more to do with a deep pride. And so the image here, quite different from Playboy bunnies, would be more the image of S&M, sadomasochism, leather and chains. Quite different compared to Playboy bunnies. And I think here we're speaking of something more diabolical. Joseph Pieper, who's my favorite 20th century Thomistic philosopher, in his book About Love, which is a great book from within more the traditional Thomistic tradition, but his chapters in that book on eros and sexuality, as well as his treatment of chastity under temperance in his book The Four Cardinal Virtues, I think in those reflections, Pieper really is on a level with Wojtyła and von Hildebrand on sexuality. But here, Pieper echoes von Hildebrand and even quotes secular psychologists who don't believe in either God or the devil, and yet they use the term demonic to describe this complete misuse or reversal of the sexual sphere. Thus, where sex is meant to be an avenue for making a gift of oneself to another on the most intimate level and receiving the free gift of the other, it can nonetheless be perverted into an avenue of deep control and even enslavement of another person through or by means of this intimate sphere, a complete reversal of what it's really meant for. And even if you say, well, you know, that sounds like you're talking about the dominant in a dominant repressive relationship, and it's really the repressive who's in control, that's still this dark manipulation from whichever point of view you want to look at it. So I would say this is a third way in which something extraordinary can be recognized about sex and its attractiveness to us, but here more as a source of power and control, of overwhelming the other person. But each of these ways acknowledge something extraordinary about sexuality compared to the other bodily appetites, but only the first does justice to the truth about sexuality. Now, I think most of us have some natural sense of this extraordinary nature of sexuality if we have not been robbed of it by being introduced to sex in some crude form before experiencing it in context, in some form of infatuation or romantic love, which would give us the context within which to understand sex. Sex falls into place when we experience falling in love or it being infatuated or ultimately a genuine betrothed love, using Wojtyła's term. But our culture tends to force images of brutal sexuality on us before we even know of or experience the kind of love which should inform this sphere. And then there's a danger of us being robbed of our natural sensitivity here. And so von Hildebrand mentions in passing another way sex can be attractive, but he doesn't put it up with the others because it's really a case of the person being blind to the extraordinary nature of the sphere and really reducing it to nothing but an animalic instinct. And so a mere animalic attraction is another possibility, but blind to the uniqueness of sexuality, missing its extraordinary nature. And this is captured in a recent rap song, which our own Christopher West, I believe, mentioned somewhere in one of his books because a student in one of my papers referred to it and mentioned him. And I don't do rap too well, but I'll do my best. You and me, baby, we ain't nothing but mammals, so let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel. Now see, this is just pathetic. And I gather in the video, it's images of animals during sexual relations. This is just total blind reductionism. But we won't go further there. All right. Second, moving on now to the second topic of the talk after discussing these three ways of attraction that recognize something extraordinary. The second topic would be three intrinsic dangers of sex, even in its proper exercise in marriage, and how these dangers can be transformed through conjugal love, especially baptized in Christ, allowing a true and pure love in the marital act. Now, let me tell a little story. Some may think it's ironic that popes comment on this. You see, Paul VI, of course, in Humanae Vitae, John Paul II unfolding a great deal more about the marital act. And some tend to think, well, who are these guys? They're a bunch of old fossilized celibates. What do they have to tell me about the marital act, you see? And I remember when I first went to Loyola of Los Angeles, I started there in 68, about a month after Humanae Vitae had been published, and it was already basically being kicked around by a football on campus. It was not treated with respect. It wasn't even seriously discussed. A lot of people just made fun of it. And I remember one of the Jesuits, there were also some great and heroic Jesuits and Catholic students who defended it, of course, but at the time it didn't get a good reception. And one of the Jesuits, I remember telling the students after Humanae Vitae, considering that Paul VI was up close to 80, he said, why would you, as young couples in love, want an 80-year-old celibate in your bedroom with you? Which is a very disturbing image, you see, and he tends to be dismissed, you see. But of course, Paul VI had no desire to be in your bedroom, but he did want to remind you that the God of life and the God of love is there, you see, and he was duty bound to remind us that God created our intimate possibilities within us and in the sexual sphere, and he's there with us, you know, not the old celibate. All right. Now, the point here is that even in the proper context of a full committed love in marriage, von Hildebrand says there can still be dangers to sexuality precisely because of its power as both a physical and a passionate experience. See, it is, in fact, the supreme act of the body. And this seems completely appropriate, considering that it involves this unitive power of giving your lives to one another until death, and its life-giving power. It seems appropriate that a new human being should come into existence through the supreme act of the body, not just by snapping your fingers, you see. And so it should be the supreme act of the body, but nonetheless, there are dangers here in such a powerful physical experience. And these dangers involve the temptation to use the other person or allow oneself to be used as a sexual object, and thus to fall into an abuse of the other's or of your own dignity. In other words, the deeper connections between love and sexuality can here be skipped over or ignored or blotted out, either on the emotional or the physical level. And so von Hildebrand discusses the problem here with what I would call the three D's in describing what can be wrong with the sexual act. He says it can become a degradation if you just use the other for pleasure in an act which should involve a deep and lasting love union and self-donation. And here he's very similar to Wojtyła, distinguishing love from use. A desecration, because something meant for a sublime purpose is being used in a way inconsistent with its dignity, and a defilement, because the seductive charm of sex unhinged from love, or even the more diabolical lust aspects, one of the false ways, are swamping and submerging the spiritual dimensions which ought to inform the sexual sphere. So he says it involves, the misuse of sexuality involves throwing away of oneself and of one's intimate secret in a superficial manner when depth and conscious commitment are called for. Now, he points out that if we recognize such dangers or tendencies in ourselves, our first response might be to try to beat them out of ourselves. In other words, to try to make yourself insensible to sexual values, as if the answer is to sort of blunt your sensitivity rather than to transform it. But insensibility is not purity. If we're insensible to sexual attractiveness, that's a defect, like colorblindness. Rather, for purity, we need to strive to incorporate sexual desire and sexual attraction into a true understanding of love. But you can't do that if you don't feel the sexual desire and sexual attraction. It has to be there in order to be incorporated into something higher. So, even in its proper place in marriage, where sexuality and its attraction has its place, it can still have three ongoing dangers. Now, the first, as I mentioned, is that this most powerful act of the body brings with it a danger of the spirit being swamped by the vital or physical nature. And that's why sex is sometimes taken as or pursued as a substitute for love or for true union. And again, Joseph Pieper develops this very well in chapter 9 of his book about love, his chapter on sexuality, where he speaks of in trying to substitute sex for love, we really move the fig leaf up from the groin to the face. And it becomes a depersonalization, but you try to make sexual union substitute for real loving personal union. And the point here would be, even in marriage, the sexual act does not have to be subjectively experienced as an act of self-donating love. This higher dimension of love may be subsumed in the physical power of the act, especially the orgasm with its power and pulsations. Then subjectively, it's not necessarily experienced as an act of love, even if one intends it so. And what this means is that the physical power of sexuality needs to be correspondingly informed by a spiritual attitude of even greater power, namely conjugal love or betrothed love in Wojtyla's terminology. And the word von Hildebrand uses in German is bräutliche Liebe, which would literally be betrothed love, although in In Defense of Purity it's even translated as wedded love and sometimes conjugal or spousal in other works. But von Hildebrand doesn't mean the kind of love that's only present after marriage vows. He means the kind of love that leads to marriage vows. And so betrothed love, even though it's a bit archaic, is probably the best way to say it, or a deep and genuine romantic love. As a kind of love, that's the kind of love that is meant to and has the power to inform the sexual sphere. And especially such love solemnly vowed for life before God. So if this betrothed love of the spouses is incorporated into the love of God, then I think we have a full integration of sex into love. Because only the power of betrothed love, a deep and genuine romantic love or falling love, in loveness, is the kind of love that's meant to inform sexuality. Friendship alone doesn't have that mission or that power, or just knowing, say, that we're brothers and sisters in Christ and then committing our wills in marriage, that opens up the sexual sphere morally and legally, but it's incapable of transforming it from within. And so it's especially betrothed love understood as a call and a vocation in Christ. This is the way God wants it for us. This is what's capable of organically informing the physical power of sexuality and elevating it to a personal act of love and self-donation, not only in our intention and in our will, but also in our experience. Now, a second intrinsic danger of sexuality, even in its proper exercise, is that one can also be falsely carried away by the passionate emotional thrill of such closeness, overwhelming the mind and will, and again, not necessarily experienced from within as an expression of love and of this particular love between us. And so, in other words, similar to the way in which an attitude of righteous indignation or justifiable wrath, which can start out good and ought to be there in the face of some terrible event. I like to use the example in my classes of if I look out the window and see a linebacker for the Pittsburgh Steelers drop kicking a baby down the street, I ought to feel righteous indignation, justifiable wrath, not just some mental conclusion, hey, he ought not to do that. See, but I should be filled with a certain justifiable wrath at it, and that's what might spur me to take on a linebacker, which I normally wouldn't do, you see. But things that start out good, due to their power, can also have a danger of overwhelming you falsely, so that I might end up killing the guy who was doing some evil deed, because I don't keep my wrath within a certain reasonable bounds. So also, love expressed sexually may start out very good, but in its emotional power, it may degenerate into using the other for powerful emotional feelings and satisfactions. And once again, I would say the antidote to this danger lies in the positive formative influence that conjugal or betrothed love is meant to have on the sexual sphere, and this also as incorporated into the love of God. So again, the marriage vows certainly make the use of the sexual sphere morally licit, but mere friendship or being brother and sister in Christ as types of love cannot inform the sexual sphere and transform it. They're not meant for this. Only a genuine being in love, betrothed or conjugal love, can do this. And then can make the sexual act not just an act of unrestrained self-indulgence, but a true act of self-donation and experienced as such, and uniquely so in light of the knowledge that this is the vocation and the expression of it willed by God and raised to the level of a sacrament, such that we lay down our lives again for one another, reconfirmed in each sexual act, and we recognize that this is in fact part of our vocation from God, and that only in God and with His approbation can we fully and completely give ourselves to one another, because we truly owe our lives to God. We belong to Him, and with His call we give ourselves to one another completely until death do us part. Now, before I get to the third intrinsic danger, let me mention with these last two points that I don't mean to say that the married couple shouldn't thoroughly enjoy the sexual act physically and emotionally. Certainly they should. We should be drawn by the pleasure and rejoice and give thanks for it. We should just not be drawn only by the pleasure or most deeply just by the pleasure, but also by the love. The love should inform the sphere. Now, a third intrinsic danger of sexuality and its proper exercise involves the fact, more in general, that the body as we find it after original sin is not exactly what God originally intended. And so, for instance, you know, if the body image that we pick up about the physical human body, if we pick up our image of the human body primarily from MTV and the World Wrestling Federation, well, then this higher dignity and these higher possibilities for the body are not going to be so apparent, you see. So the body is not always experienced as the vehicle or the possible vehicle for the expression of the highest spiritual attitudes of man, like love. And so for some, I think the physicality and the thrusting and the wide open positions associated with the sex act may be experienced or interpreted as something more brutal or animalic, as if unworthy of a spiritual being. And here, my teacher as an undergraduate, Rhonda Chervin, who had studied under von Hildebrand, she wrote an article given as a talk entitled Redeeming Sexual Love in Marriage that was published in the Leinecker Quarterly in 1988 after Donum Vitae came out from the Vatican. And she denotes this attitude as angelism, see, where if someone would prefer, rather than the full wide open sex act, why couldn't we just have a tender little kiss, and when we wanted to, we could conceive a baby from a beautiful little kiss, you see. But all this other stuff, the wide open says, too much for me. That's just too much animalic, you see. And I think that's a problem. Or again, on a more innocent level, children, when first introduced to the physical closeness of sexuality, even of a kiss, will often react with, ooh, who would ever want to do that, you see? Touching your lips together, exchanging something, give me a break, you see? It's in light, though, of falling in love, you see? It's in light of romantic love or betrothed love that bodily expressions become understandable and attractive and appropriate. And also, once again, having God approvingly involved helps to avoid these dangers. In other words, knowing that a God of love made us this way and that He means for us to love each other this way, knowing that this is good and appropriate in light of the incarnate God who took on a body, all this can help to positively inform the physical dimensions and see the body more clearly as a proper avenue for the expression of the highest spiritual attitude of love. It's important to note, therefore, that nothing of what I've said has anything to do with prudishness or disgust at the sexual sphere or rejection of the body as evil or any mere psychological fear of closeness or oversensitivity to touching. I had a roommate in college who'd never wanted to be touched. He didn't even want to shake your hand. And so naturally, he never got married. See, if he couldn't take a handshake, forget the rest of it, you see. But these latter things are not virtue, but defect. Finally, it's only when love and sexuality are seen and transformed in the light of Christ that the full import and presence of the virtue of purity is confirmed. So purity involves, first, wanting to be truly and genuinely loving. And so that involves a deep understanding of the positive aspects of the sexual sphere and the mystery and depth involved in both its unitive, lifelong call to love and vocation, and procreative, co-creators with God of a new eternal person. Both of these dimensions are involved in the truth about sexuality and a pure love informing it. And then secondly, I would say, purity also involves wanting God to be present for us both as loving sexual partners, for us both to be transparent before God. And here Wojtyła and von Hildebrand and other authors like Soren Kierkegaard all use this image of transparency before God in describing purity or chastity. In other words, we don't want to hide from Him. As opposed to Adam and Eve hiding from God after their sin. We recognize the God of love and intimacy is present with us, has made us this way, wants us to be this way, and it's something noble and beautiful and chaste. So God is with us in our intimate love. He is the God of intimacy and love. Now, turning then, that leads up to the point of turning to the ideal of purity in the exercise of sexuality in committed conjugal love. Here we can see the marital act as a special occasion for transmitting a genuine love to one another and for seeing and experiencing the ultimate significance of sexuality as ordained to a self-giving and self-sacrificing spousal love in a profound and mysterious union in imitation of the Trinitarian God of love and in light of the incarnate God, in light of Christ. Now, this wedded purity can again display itself in several stages. First, it would involve always a deep-rooted will to purity, firmly so chosen as a positive virtue. Yet this commitment of the will, involving some understanding with the intellect, this will to purity, however, does not by itself emancipate the heart from being captured in the main still by the charm of sexuality as an isolated or selfish end in itself. Therefore, the next stage of purity would be when that will to purity has become organic enough in one's thoughts and desires and emotions that one has for the most part won the battle and is now only assaulted by isolated temptations towards separating sex from your own deep committed love. But then thirdly, the perfection of purity, which von Hildebrand calls a special grace, would involve being deeply sensitive to the positive aspects of sex, but without any isolated selfish satisfaction, much less evil lust, but rather where one is only sexually interested, only sexually attracted, only sexually aroused toward one's spouse and in the service of conjugal love. When one is subject to the qualities of a tender intimacy and a deep reverence and a touching surrender and to the mysterious power of sex to unite us in deep loving communion. Now, when I was 16, I thought that was impossible. See, that you would only be sexually aroused by one woman, your wife. When I was 16, every girl aroused me. See? And yet, that's not the height of purity, you see. And it doesn't express that committed love. Now, you might think this is impossible, but here I like to tell the story of Joe Namath compared to Roger Staubach. Roger Staubach, of course, was this known as a fine, upstanding fellow. He was a Catholic, married, three kids, and got the Heisman Trophy at the Naval Academy, but then instead of trying to cash in on millions in football, served out his years with the Navy and then tried to come back to football. Some people thought he would fail, but he was recognized as a sort of a noble personality for that, and as I say, was a faithful husband and father of three kids. And when he won the Super Bowl in 1972, a female announcer asked him, well, Roger, don't you feel that a little something is missing? Here you've just won the Super Bowl. Now, when Joe Namath, who was known as a partier around New York, when he won the Super Bowl in 1969, he went out and partied all over New York for the whole weekend with two women on each arm. And he said he only regretted that it was only one of him and not enough to go around to all the women of New York. See? But you, Roger, all you can do is go home to your wife. You see? Now, he got rather upset with that. I think if it had been a male announcer, he might have gotten a knuckle sandwich. But it was female. But he was visibly upset, and then he said, he just stared her down and said, listen, lady, I enjoy sex every bit as much as Joe Namath, but I only enjoy it with one woman. See? Perfect answer. And I think that's what purity involves. It's in the service of this love relationship. Now I wish to turn in the final section of the talk, the section on consecrated virginity as a call from God, to the question of what could be the reason for renouncing such a high good as the sexual sphere. Because the question arises, if man and woman are so deeply called to complementary and fulfilling union, and if marriage even represents the love between God and His people, God and the church, well then, why the supposed call to celibacy or virginity? Is this just some sort of Manichaean leftover of suspicion of the body and sex as evil? Which is what Hugh Hefner and Larry Flint would confidently assert, you see, that celibacy or virginity is simply unnatural and Christians are weird, you see. Well, of course, I don't think that's true, but the explanation is required. And this brings us to three reasons why the use of one's sexual powers might be renounced. First, one reason why some in the history of the human race and of some aberrant traditions within Christianity have recommended or called for renouncing sex is because they do see the body and sex as evil. And in that light, you see, virginity becomes the only possible moral way of life. Now, this involves a type of shame, in this case over sex and the body, which supposedly tries to hide that which is evil or ugly. And that's the only kind of shame that Hugh Hefner admits, you see, that Christians are ashamed of the body because they think it's evil. Hefner seems to think that that's a given. However, von Hildebrand, like Wojtyla half a century later, deals positively with another type or reason for shame. It's not grounded only in hiding something ugly or evil. Besides that kind of negative shame, there's a distinctly positive shame which rather hides what is most deeply private or intimate in the person. Why? Because such a sphere is not meant to be public, because the glare of the public cannot do justice to its depth and intimacy. And thus we may hide deep and intimate emotions, whether positive ones whereby we may express joy to the point of tears, or on the other hand, a noble and genuine sorrow or mourning. Even where these are deeply grounded and beautiful responses, such intimate moments should not be intruded upon by a TV camera, for instance. How do you feel, ma'am? Tell me about your sorrow. See, it just doesn't come across, I think, in the public square. It can't do justice to the depth and intimacy. Similarly, before the lights come up in a theater, you may quickly dry your eyes if you've been touched to tears by the movie, because the public gaze simply can't do justice to the deep and intimate emotions. And you know your tears may be a source of razzing and ridicule depending upon the crowd you're with. So you may hide them, but not because they're evil or wrong. On a much deeper level, note that Christ, when he began his passion in tears of repentance, repenting for each of our sins to his Father in the Garden of Gethsemane, he chose to start his passion in solitude and privacy for that intimate act of confession. First with his 12 apostles, then with his chosen three, then by himself. And after that intimate exchange between his Father and himself, only then did he go forth to meet the public gaze. So parallel to such noble emotions and their reason for shame, shame over sexuality is meant to guard its intimate, revelatory, personal character from superficial and demeaning gaze. It's not at all meant to cover up something evil, but rather to guard something deeply good. So this first motive for virginity, to avoid something evil, is completely misguided and thoroughly unchristian. The incarnation, above all else, affirms the goodness of matter and of the body and of sexuality. Nonetheless, Christians are often accused of this kind of Manichaean prudishness if they try to defend purity or chastity. However, a second reason for the voluntary renunciation of the positive use of our sexual powers lies in the evangelical councils. Von Hildebrand points out that all three of the evangelical councils, that is, taking vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, have a special role in bringing the soul to Christ in a direct way and in combating certain dangers and temptations in the world. So the vow of chastity, like that of poverty or obedience, shares in a certain ascetical distance and purification even from the legitimate goods of this world as a way of avoiding lapses due to the residual effects of pride and concupiscence, and rather centering most directly on the one thing necessary. Again, the purpose here is to promote a particular undividedness, and that not just from dangers or superficial things, but rather even high and lofty goods meant in their natural function to lead us beyond themselves toward the God of love and the giver of gifts and toward service to others. But just because these created goods are so high, they can also become a source of dividedness. In other words, it's much easier to understand why someone may make the girl they fall in love with into a false idol than to make your stamp collection into a false idol, like the absolute center of your life. The higher the good is, the more it can serve as a substitute for the true absolute. Now, these highest goods and beauties, as I said, have a God-given positive natural role meant to take us beyond themselves and out of any mere circling around ourselves. And so the true, the good, and the beautiful are meant to lead us upward toward God as their source, fulfillment, and end. And this is what marriage and children do. They lead us away from circling around ourselves. They open us up more to others. And so as John Paul II says, the fact that man is created male and female already indicates this vocation of self-giving in the very depths of our being. We're meant to be helpmates in communion with one another on our way to our ultimate vocation in God. However, in the evangelical councils of poverty, chastity, and obedience, even these high natural goods, like marriage, are renounced, and the mission that they naturally have to lead our hearts upward is transferred in faith to be fulfilled more directly by God and His love and grace. And you might think, well, who would presume such a thing? Well, of course, only those who have been so called. And it is a special call, needing to be tested by the church through a spiritual advisor, through a time of postulancy and novitiate, temporary vows, etc. Then, if exercised, the evangelical councils hope to combat the three great enemies of the soul in a more special and direct way. So the vow of poverty hopes in a direct way to combat the lust of the eyes, the vow of chastity, the lust of the flesh, and the vow of obedience, the pride of life, by renouncing even the legitimate right to ownership, the legitimate right to marry, the legitimate right to freedom. And so in this light, it's a special call of a more direct way to God, parallel to the natural way in which the high natural goods point us beyond themselves toward God, but a special way. However, even all these parallels between the vow of chastity and the other two, the vows of poverty and obedience, all these parallels do not exhaust all that the church seems to have to say on the topic. So far, so good. However, the church has also valued in a special and unique way not just the vow of chastity, which a married man like St. Peter may later be called to, but the church has also valued in a special way the call to the state of perpetual virginity. Now, why this? Does this finally indicate some problem with the good of sexuality? Is this finally the Manichaean leftover which Hugh Hefner is forever searching for? And again, I would say no. In answer to this objection, I think we must again recall the natural mystery of sexuality, that it involves a secret and intimate dimension of every human being, and that the disclosure and delivery of this dimension to another involves a unique self-surrender and self-donation, a giving of oneself in the most total and complete way possible in this world. Now, what the person consecrated to perpetual virginity does is take this secret, this intimate dimension inside, and place it, so to speak, unopened or untouched in the hands of Christ, sealed forever as a special self-surrender to Him, a special gift to Him, involving a spiritual marriage with Him of one's complete self. So the consecrated virgin makes a vow, a betrothal to Christ, never to disclose this secret to anyone else. She herself, her intimate secret, is the very subject of this vow, speaking here of every soul in the feminine. Thus, there is a center in the human person, a secret and intimate dimension of our being, which in the present state of things could only be disclosed through the exercise of sexuality. And it's this intimate dimension which is now sealed up forever for the love of Christ, and also as a witness to and anticipation of the life of heaven and the fullness of intimate love in heaven, beyond what we can imagine. In other words, it's a witness to the final call and the final state of every human being. Now, again, this might sound a little too far out, so to try to make it more understandable on a human level, I like to use an example to illustrate this, which is well done in the movie The Song of Bernadette, if you've ever seen it. And it's reported in the book on page 458 and seems to be based in fact. but I believe it's done even better as seen in the movie. As Bernadette is driven off to the nunnery in a carriage, the carriage stops so that the young man from the neighboring farm, the miller Antoine Nicolau, who loves her, and there's been a sort of a hint throughout the book that they might have really fallen in love and lived a normal married life together, you see. Well, then this is somewhat interrupted by visions from heaven, you see. And then with her spiritual director, Bernadette decides maybe having received direct heavenly vision, she should lead a different kind of life. And Antoine has not come to the party that day. The whole town had a party to say goodbye to Bernadette and to thank her, and he never showed up. And I think the implication is he can't share what's in his heart in the midst of a public party. So he waits for the carriage to go by. There's two nuns in it, plus Bernadette. And he stops the carriage to say goodbye privately and says that just like her, he has decided never to get married. And he makes some point about how he has to take care of his elderly parents. And she sort of senses there's a deeper reason here, and she says to him, well, you know, someone else may come along for you. And he looks at her very deeply and says, no, there could be no one else, you see. And the implication seems to be that, you see, except for the direct intervention of God in the visions, in the marital Marian visions, except for the Mary appearing, the two of them might have gotten married, and that's what he thought his vocation was. But after the visions, once she's become convinced to lead a life more directly focused on the one thing necessary, he says he's decided never to marry. But the clear implication is that he feels that this intimate sphere of sexuality, this secret of his being, was meant for her and for no one else. And if he can't share it with her, he doesn't want to share it with anyone else. And he comes across as genuinely happy and in this whole resolve, you see, that he vows to seal up that sphere and not reveal it to any other girl out of love for her. And I think that captures something of what the vow means in relation to Christ. Now, similarly, I think this is why many men and women, as widows or widowers, may not desire to share that intimate sphere again with another, even though they have the right to do so. They can marry again. But they may feel, well, I don't really want to. I shared that with that one person, and I don't really want to share it with another. And I say in a similar fashion, except in this case, it's more for Christ himself directly and from the beginning, the consecrated virgin seals up this sphere for God, the final and ultimate spouse of our souls. Therefore, the mystery which marriage represents, that is, the nuptials between Christ and his people, Christ and his church, of which we're all ultimately called to be members, is even more directly signified by consecrated virginity. And I think this helps us to see that just as it is in response to a special call from God that some vow to seal this sphere of special intimacy up forever for Christ in consecrated virginity, so it also requires a special call to lift the veil of this intimate sphere and enter the secret garden of sexuality in marriage. Marriage, too, is a special call, a special vocation, raised indeed to the level of a sacrament. Both are special calls to loving service, to self-sacrifice, to self-donation, and to union. In marriage, we're called to walk together hand in hand toward Christ in a special way and with special duties and responsibilities to God and to one another. In consecrated virginity, the call is to be a more direct witness to the bridal relation that Christ holds with each soul, and to witness to the fullness of his love and the ultimate and final state of man, even now in this world. Moreover, both are special calls, special gifts. Thus, if neither of these special calls is given in a person's life, Nonetheless, the vocation of each soul still remains the love of God with one's whole heart, mind, and will and strength, and the love of neighbor as oneself. Nothing can hinder us from the love of God and our call to love Him in return, even if neither of those two special calls is given. And thus, I like to close with a story von Hildebrand recounts in his footnote on page 106 of the Purity Book about St. Catherine of Genoa, a married saint. And here's how the footnote goes. One day, a Dominican friar, quote, perhaps to test her or because of some mistaken notion, told her that he himself was better fitted for loving than she was, because he, having entered religion and renounced all things, both within and without, and she being married to the world as he was to religion, he found himself more free to love God and more acted upon by him. And the friar went on and alleged many other reasons. And when he had spoken much and long, an ardent flame of pure love seized upon Catherine, and she sprang to her feet with such fervor as to appear beside herself and said, quote, if I thought that your religious habit had the power of gaining me one single additional spark of love, I should without fail take it from you by force if I were not allowed to have it otherwise. That you should merit more than myself is a matter that I concede and do not seek. I leave it in your hands. But that I cannot love him as much as you is a thing that you will never by any means be able to make me understand, unquote. And she said this with such force and fervor that all her hair came undone and falling down was scattered about her shoulders. And yet all the while her vehement bearing was full of grace and dignity. And when back at home and alone with her Lord, she exclaimed, O love, who shall impede me from loving thee? Though I were not only in the world as I am, but in a camp of soldiers, I could not be impeded from loving thee. Unquote. So let us each seek to live out the vocation of love which God has given to us one by one, as He has called us each by name. Thank you.